The Tom Woods Show, episode 619.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm hosting a cruise with Bob Murphy in October 2016. It's the Contra Cruise, and we are going to have a blast. We're going to have so much fun on this thing. 30% of the cabins are already sold out, and we've only been promoting it about a month. So don't miss it. Check it out at ContraCruise.com. Hey, everybody. Email marketing is a critical, indispensable ingredient in your business. And if you know how to do it right, you can have tremendous success. But if you do it the wrong way, oh, it's a disaster. Fortunately, Daniel Levis, who happens to be a libertarian and is one of the world's great email marketers, is giving away some helpful video and a PDF at tomwoods.com/Daniel. Grab them before he takes them down. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking about Murray Rothbard and Austrian economics today. But in particular, we're talking about a way it can be explained that will make it more, I don't know, understandable to the mainstream, that maybe the mainstream can be more sympathetic to us. There's an interesting new article at Mises.org that I'll be linking to at tomwoods.com/619 that will go into more detail about this. But right now we have as our guest the author of that article, and that is our friend Professor Anthony Mueller, who is a professor at the Federal University of Sergipe in Brazil. He's also academic director of Mises Brazil, the Mises Institute of Brazil. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking today about an article of yours, and I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/619, which is the show notes page for today, and it's about how Rothbard's depression theory is more relevant than ever. Now, I have talked quite a bit on this show about Austrian business cycle theory, which is more or less Rothbard's theory, and oftentimes the guests and I just kind of take for granted that the listeners already know what Austrian business cycle theory is, but that's probably not the best approach for us to have taken. So why don't we at least begin this conversation with at least a basic overview of what is it that makes Rothbard so different from other economists in the way he looked at the causes and cures of depressions?
Well, the major difference and the deep difference is that Rothbard and the Austrians have a strong laissez-faire position. They say, and this is sometimes hard to convey to most people, that the best way to deal when a recession begins is simply to start nothing. While nowadays, as since the Great Depression, different from the myth that there was no intervention, we have an interventionist tradition, and as soon as the slightest signal appear, there could be an economic downturn. We hear all kinds of measures that need to be taken to prevent a deeper downturn. In fact, these activities have more prolonged or deepened recessions, and the last one since 2008 is an example of that. Now, when we try to explain the Rothbardian or the Austrian approach, this is very difficult to say, well, we just do nothing. Why shouldn't we do nothing? That's the big problem. Because, I mean, when there's a problem, it's always easy. What do we have to do? Now, when someone says, it's like in medicine, when some doctor would say, well, it's best to do nothing, that needs more explanation than those that are in favor of an active policy.
Right.
Now, in this respect, my paper is a contribution why we shouldn't do anything.
All right. So what would be then of the things that people might propose that we would do? Let's list those and then think about what it is. What would be the main reason that Rothbard would say every one of them would be a bad idea? And then we can talk about what your own particular contribution is here. So, for example, fiscal and monetary stimulus are often recommended. What's wrong with those approaches? It seems like what we need is another burst of economic activity, and surely these forms of stimulus would give us that activity. What's wrong with that?
Well, let's put it in simple terms and compare a recession as a signal for the economy that the capital structure is moving in the wrong way. Let's compare it to a person who is going on some way to some place, and then after a short distance, he notes that he has gone the wrong way. The right reaction is now to go back and choose the right way. And this is similar what happens in recessions, fluctuations. The entrepreneur notice, or those that are in certain areas that represent wrong investments, that they have to move back. And this, of course, has elements of a recession, to stop investment, to reconsider investment, and so on. Now, let's assume this person now gets all kinds of incentives in this way from the government to move on. Well, you can move on this way. Go on this way. The truth is that by this impulses, by this stimuli to move on into the wrong direction, the misstructure of the economy increases and is not being reduced. Of course, as long as, let's say, the person moves on, the economy goes on, there is economic activity, there is employment, and so on. Yeah, but we are doing the wrong things. And that is the point of the Rothbardian approach that I would like to bring over, which usually is not very much discussed in this kind of way. Why shouldn't we do anything?
Well, let me take a minute, if you wouldn't mind, to give an analogy that I recently used on an episode of the other podcast I do, Contra Krugman, just to make sure people understand what we mean when we say that something is unsustainable or we're doing the wrong thing. Mises gives this this wonderful allegory of the master builder who's building some home or something according to a blueprint that would require more physical resources than actually exist. So if he continues building according to this blueprint, he's just making more and more errors. He's pouring time and resources into something that can never be finished. And the analogy to the economy is that entrepreneurs have been misled by the central bank's intervention into thinking that more investment projects are possible to be completed than can actually be completed. So yes, we can stimulate further activity in that direction, but we don't want to go in that direction. The same way we don't want the master builder to continue going in his direction according to that blueprint. The blueprint is faulty. He shouldn't be building according to that blueprint. So that's what we mean when we say we're doing the wrong thing. We're on the wrong path. So yes, obviously we could stimulate activity, but activity in the abstract is not what we want. We want productive activity in the interest of producing according to consumer preferences and resource availability. Have I got it?
Yes. We want to do the right thing, and we want to have an economic structure that is working in the long run, that is sustainable, as one can say. There is one additional aspect to this that, at least for me, took some time to find out, reading also Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. The function of the capitalist, in his view, is not just the entrepreneurial function that we were talking about, but also the function of the capitalist. The function of the capitalist is to maintain this immense capital structure. Now, to maintain this capital structure, we need resources. A simple way to name that is savings. Our savings depend on our production by itself. Now, the point to note is that we can overextend the capital structure so that the savings we have available are not sufficient to maintain this extended structure. I always used another example to make this clear to the layperson. Let's say we have a normal income. We are normal guys, regular guys, and we have a super rich uncle who gives us a Ferrari. Now, at the first moment, that is a great thing. We are richer, so to speak. We feel wealthy. We can impress everybody. But now comes the point: can we maintain? Now, a Ferrari, for one, is not a capital good, but just to compare, we just aren't rich enough to maintain an item such a Ferrari, because only the regular repair cost a fortune. And this happens all of the time in the economies, particularly, and that's maybe why I hit on that, because I live in Brazil, in the poorer economies, where it's more obvious to see, like Brazil or Argentina or some other semi or emerging economy, where large government projects are launched to develop the country, to build great infrastructure, and then one notices they cannot maintain it. The saving is just not enough. Because spending, as the Keynesians say, of course, spending creates jobs, creates economic activity. But spending has all the other effect that we all know. Every spending is also cost. When I spend something, I have costs. And when I spend too much, I have too much costs. And when I produce, let's say, a house, let's say this example of Mises with a master builder, it's like a person with a regular income, would just get a house that is too large for him or her to maintain. That is the main point. And it fits very well. And that's why I have created this model. This fits perfectly well with the so-called neoclassical growth model. That's an interesting point to bring it over to the mainstream, so to speak.
Okay, so here's where I'd like you, in layman's terms and as simply as possible, to explain for us the basic neoclassical growth model, and then let's see how it can possibly be fit together with the Austrian view of the business cycle.
This model goes back to the 50s, and its element basically are that the output is characterized of an economy by diminishing marginal returns, and only technical progress can economic growth make continue. Now, when we look away from technical growth, because it does not even it does not happen all of the time. There are periods, especially in developing countries, where there is not much technical progress going on. They have to import know-how and so on. Now, with this output, our income is determined, and our income determines the savings we can generate. However, as the output is subject to diminishing marginal returns, the costs of capital maintenance are linear. They continue more or less with the same margin. They do not return. They do not diminish, and probably also not increase. So we can say they are linear. So there's a point where more capital that we invest renders less income. But to maintain this additional capital, we have to use as much resources to maintain as before. And this is a collapse between the return and the costs. Let's put it this way. Also an example, a carriage and a horse. So you have the capital, which is the horse, and one person. And then you put on two horses or three horses or four horses, and one notes that with each horse we have an additional output, but each additional horse will contribute less to the production. And if you imagine we have six horses in front of a small cart, so we can see that this sixth horse will produce relatively little, but this sixth or fifth or seventh horse costs as much to maintain as the first and the second, that are very productive. They need the same food, they need the same attainment. So there you have a clash, and you rarely see a carriage with four or five horses. Let's say it's a small carriage. So there's a relationship between capital and production and maintenance of this capital. That is the point that I want to bring over. And this is mainstream in this respect for the neoclassical growth theory, and it fits perfectly well to what Rothbard said, because he said we have to reduce capital, we have to liquidate capital, which always is cited as a joke, as you know, in the popular press or by Krugman and so on. So we are the liquidationists that want to liquidate capital. But what is it? What does it mean? It means we have too many horses.
Right. That's a good analogy. Too many horses leading a carriage. You don't want to have six horses. They're consuming too much, and you don't even need six horses to do the job.
Yes, exactly.
Very interesting analogy. All right. So tomwoods.com/619 is going to have that. And you've got a full graphical representation. And it will be useful also, I think, for the many college students I have who listen in and who are taking economics in school and who are going to be encountering a lot of the concepts you just talked about.
That would be great to have this audience. That's the main point I want to bring over to this group of people.
Yeah, so they can see how there can be an Austrian take on what it is that they're saying. They're not just learning stuff that's completely preposterous and can't be – I mean, this is a way that we can speak to the mainstream. Is that the way you were thinking about it?
Yes, that is the main objective. I think it is very important, and the time is really ripe nowadays, because we have made great advancement in the Austrian school, and the mainstream is more open for alternative views. And of course, your show is extremely helpful because of the audience that include many students, particularly in the area of the social sciences and economics.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask you, even though we did talk about Brazil some time ago, if you could just say a little something about Brazil, because for a long time Brazil, whether you know it or not, in the rest of the world, Brazil was being held up as a wonderful example of a prospering economy that had a healthy, and by healthy they mean large, public sector. And this goes to show that stupid idiots like me are all wrong, because look at the great success Brazil is having. What is the real truth of that?
Well, actually, Brazil is a good case for this model. You have this large sector, you have many public investments, and Brazil has always tried to industrialize and to have a huge infrastructure. But there have always been setbacks, grave setbacks, terrible setbacks. Yeah, this happened, for example, in the 80s, and a similar episode happened in the recent time when the new government came into power in early 2000, and had again this prospect of now we are overtaking Great Britain. That was really the talk, with huge investments and by a strange idea. That is even stranger when we think about the Rothbardian model, because here they have the dominance of the post-Keynesians, while in the rest of the world they are more the new Keynesians in power. Here are the post-Keynesians that also believe that one can, let's say, grow the economy through consumption. So there was a gigantic consumption splurge initiated by the public sector.
And how would you describe the condition of Brazil right now? Here we're talking in early 2016.
Well, there is also a political crisis, because with this huge public sector which has companies, a lot of public companies, there is a bonanza for corruption, and now a new generation has grown up that in the legal departments and so on that seem not to accept that anymore, and there are a severe investigation in the corruption. Corruption scandal and an impeachment process against the current president. So these are also political facts. But ironically, somewhat ironically, I would say, as the Brazilian economy tanks right now in a severe way, we simply see the result of the policies that were implemented before the current recession, but it can also be a very interesting experiment because of the political mess right now, the government is pretty paralyzed and largely unable to implement new government programs against the recession. So by a strange coincidence, the government is practically forced to do nothing, to have a hands-off approach. So we have two very interesting experiments right now going on, and that the Brazilian economy was on the wrong path could easily be seen for the Austrians already 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, it'll be interesting, obviously, to see what happens in the future. And for that, obviously, I'm going to turn to you because I guess I do know some people in Brazil, but none quite as well as you. So I'm glad to get a little bit of confirmation of what I suspected was going on in Brazil, and also to talk a little bit about your article on Rothbard, business cycle theory, and the mainstream. Again, this is all available at tomwoods.com/619. Well, Professor Mueller, I appreciate your time today, and perhaps we'll talk to you again one of these days soon.
Thank you very much, Tom. It was a pleasure.
All right, folks, if I have any business people, any entrepreneurs in the audience, remember, email marketing is where it's at. You got to know how to sell through email. These days, it is the best tool you have. Even today, it is still the best tool you have, but almost everybody uses it the wrong way. Well, Daniel Levis, the great libertarian who is also one of the great email marketers of our time, is in teaching mode right now, and he's got a free PDF and video series that you should check out because you're shooting yourself in the foot if you don't know how to do email marketing correctly. Check it all out at tomwoods.com/Daniel. Tomorrow, Karen Katowski is back on the show, and boy, is that going to be a lot of fun. Thanks for listening. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.